Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. Samuel Abrams will be joining me today to talk, firstly, about what boys lose when they stop studying history. Many of you who listen to this program know that I'm a self-taught student of history. I didn't study history by any tertiary education standards. However, I want to point out that we often imagine our founders as older figures, seasoned statesmen, philosophers who arrived at their achievements after long and careful preparation, but many of them were really strikingly young. We cannot forget this. Many of them were barely in their 20s, some of them. And if we forget this, we do our students a disservice. We do our young a disservice. I've said this time and time again. One of the great issues we suffer from in the West is the prolonged infantilization of each subsequent generation, when we ought to and can expect from them real adult responsibilities, seeing as we're giving many of them real adult privileges. Therefore, not forgetting that with their age, however young they are, comes a tremendous amount of intellectual and social responsibility is a crucial responsibility of ours, because we do them a disservice, especially for young men. Samuel Abrams and I will talk about this. After that, we will speak with Dean John Czarnecki of Ave Maria School of Law. He gives us an analysis about what happened with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments over President Trump's executive order that attempts to end automatic birthright citizenships. This is a crucial and frankly tenuous conversation and situation, and we do need to have a reasoned discussion about it. And then finally, we will be talking about the origins of Catholic social doctrine and recovering that well. This is in part due to a series of articles put out by Matthew Walls in the Catholic World Report. And this is a crucial conversation to be had, to be sure, because especially with the continued decline in the way Catholics think about the Catholic faith and the social order, we need to reclaim the fact that the origins of Catholic social teaching are not just doctrinal, but deeply based in natural law as well. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, April 7th. It's the Feast of St. John Baptiste de La Salle. Today's news is brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. Multiple reports say Iran is cutting all communication with the U.S. as President Trump's 8 p.m. Eastern deadline for Iran to make a deal gets closer. Trump's warning that a whole civilization will die tonight if Iran doesn't make a deal to end the war, promising to destroy the country's power plants and bridges. The Iranian government called on civilians to act as human shields in front of the country's power plants, and video shows at least one instance of it. In its latest statement, the White House says, quote, "The Iranian regime has until 8 p.m. to meet the moment and make a deal with the U.S. Only the president knows where things stand and what he'll do." France is celebrating a record in baptisms. The country recorded more than 20,000 adult and adolescent baptisms this Easter, a 20% increase from last year. Data shows the majority of converts are young adults between the ages of 18 to 25, closely followed by the 26 to 40-year-old age group. Women constitute the largest segment, accounting for approximately 62% of the total. ICE say officers opened fire at a man in Northern California this morning after he weaponized his vehicle. Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons says the officers were trying to arrest an alleged gang member wanted in El Salvador at the time of the incident. The suspect was taken to the hospital, but his condition hasn't been released. And Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche says healthcare fraud is one of his top priorities as he replaces outgoing AG Pam Bondi. He said in just this week, the DOJ secured a sentencing and two guilty pleas for a half a billion dollars in healthcare and COVID fraud. from your AveMariaRadio.net news desk. I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Some time ago when I used to teach high school, I thought long and hard about one of the main problems we have here in the developed West, and that has to do with the continued infantilization of our subsequent generations. With each generation, we are raising children, perpetualized children, and that's a problem. Because when I used to look around my classroom and see that room full of 18-year-olds just simply unable to function as adults embracing full social responsibility and the consequences of their actions thereof, it became increasingly clear to me that there was a horrible defunct in formation, particularly with regard to faith, with philosophy and reason, to be sure. We expect so little of them in terms of the life of the mind, and yet we expect so much of them when it comes to STEM education, to be sure. And history, a real immersion in history from a sound objective perspective. I'm not talking about social science and skewing it from a progressivist lens. I'm talking about being real students of history. And I want to focus on boys here. When boys stop studying history, they lose more than school subjects. They lose a sense of proportion about their role in society and the world. They lose what one would call social memory and a working sense of duty that ought to be undergirding every single individual in the society. Boys, especially, will lose a standard by which they ought to measure themselves, which is against the men of previous generations who were required to grow up early and who actually did and accomplished magnificent things. And after that loss, our society then hands them glowing screens and therapeutic slogans, and we call that maturity. And that's an extremely efficient way to produce adult-sized children who speak endlessly about their identity and self-expression and have no concept of the duty they owe to society and the common good. As a student of history myself, a constant student of history, I can tell you right now, history gives boys an encounter with consequence. It teaches them that ideas can become social structures. Those social structures can then become laws. Those laws can become habits. And those habits can form anywhere from regimes to governments to whole nations. But those regimes then have an impact on your home, your church, your market, your work, your school, what have you. And that's why a boy who studies history begins to see that liberty has a lineage. Disorder also has one. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration at age 33, or his monstrous contribution to it, was at age 33. Madison was 36 at the Constitutional Convention. Washington had already become a professional surveyor at 17. He completed his first survey within 2 days of receiving his commission. These men were young, they were serious, they were entrusted with tasks that would shape whole civilizations. These were not men waiting for permission to become adults at age 32 or after one final era of needing to travel to the East to quote-unquote find themselves. And that's a big part of the problem today. We've stretched adolescence into a lifestyle. And now we market it in the name of liberty, of discovering yourself. In the United States, 18% of adults aged 25 to 34 continue to live in their parents' basement or in their parents' home. This was in 2023. Young men did so more often than young women. 20% of men did this. 15% of young women did this. Meanwhile, the median age at first marriage has risen to about 31. For men. Now, some of this comes from a lot of economic reasons, housing costs, unstable work, delayed earning, and they're real serious social pressures. But some of it also comes from a culture that has trained young men to defer responsibility for as long as possible, and that permanent postponement is an option. I'm saying some of it on purpose, because I don't want to exaggerate. The economy matters. Wages matter, housing matters, family breakdown matters, sure. But historical illiteracy is what I want to focus on here. Boys who never meet Washington the surveyor, Jefferson the draftsman, Madison the constitutional architect, Hamilton the author, they all begin to assume that manhood is this recreational thing with employment being the unfortunate tack on. And so they absorb the lie that that kind of seriousness only belongs to old men, and even then not all of them, just some of them in society, especially those who wind up in portraits, and that youth can be prolonged and exists for self-expression. 50 is the new 40, 60 is the new what have you. History shatters that illusion. History actually tells us that a boy that has youth has often been at that age for apprenticeship, of sacrifice, command, courage, public usefulness. John Adams, one of my favorite founding fathers, had a severe sense of speaking about this. I must study politics and war that my sons may have liberty to study painting and poetry, mathematics and philosophy. That's the theory of civilization, my friends. One generation accepts burden so that the next may inherit a certain sense of order, but that doesn't mean that the next one is then devoid of the duty of accepting burden themselves. One generation needs to learn what is costly and build what is lovely so that the next generation can learn to appreciate that as well. Boys need that truth. It introduces them to delayed gratification, to heroism in virtue. It teaches boys that the adult life is not about self-consumption. It's about stewardship across generations after you. You build that others may appreciate long after you're gone. That's serving the common good. That's why history humbles a boy, but it doesn't humiliate him. It's a great teacher. It shows him that men of genius and men of vice can not only coexist with each other, very often they are the same person. We can think about the fact that Jefferson was a brilliant defender of liberty, but at the same time, he was entangled in slavery and he was a deist. Washington had extraordinary discipline and he had to navigate the brutal world of 18th century power. The founders were not plastered saints. We can't canonize them, but we also don't want to caricaturize them into villains. These were men acting within a particularly contested moral world. And that's precisely why studying them forms right judgment. A boy then learns to admire greatness where greatness is, but also to detect failure where failure is, to resist the childish urge to flatten every historical figure into either saints or monsters, which unfortunately is the childishness we are seeing in particularly progressivist movements when it comes to how they assess history. In fact, I believe that if we all became real, honest students of history, that would improve public discourse by several miles. Our present civic ignorance is not by chance. This is exactly why we are where we are. We wonder why every social argument gets swallowed by hysteria. Well, it's because we are people without history. And if we are steeped, we are people without being steeped in history, we become easy to flatter, but also easy to frighten and intimidate. Every controversy sounds unprecedented. Oh, we've never faced anything like this before. Every election is apocalyptic. This is the most important election in the history of the United States. Or every activist claim seems to be the first prophet of justice. No one else has ever said this before. This prophet is saying it. Every grifter will sell their truth as novelty to people because they don't know the history well enough to know that it's been taught before and sold before. And that's why the study of history can help resolve a lot of social problems. Partially, not entirely. Christ is the real panacea here. It doesn't wave away sin or heal every wound or close every budget gap, but it gives citizens a moral imagination, a political antibody, if you will. It teaches young men how republics rise, but also how they decay, how to prevent that decay, how to build that civilization. Freedom requires self-command, that institutions become fragile when the people inside them become frivolous. In the face of all of this, I challenge everyone, give a boy history and you give him a mirror large enough to expose his smallness without crushing his spirit. So steep him in the fathers. Let him get to know them. In fact, that gift might actually start a minor revolution for the good. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Join Catholics at the Shore 2026, May 7th through the 9th, at the beautiful Icona in Avalon, New Jersey. This year's theme, Needing Nothing More, invites you to step away from the noise and encounter Christ. Speakers include Patricia Heaton, UFC champion Boss Rutten, and pro-life activist Christian Hawkins, along with other powerful Catholic voices. To learn more, go to CatholicsAtTheShore.com.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we?" The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments over President Trump's executive order that attempts to end automatic birthright citizenship. Dean John Czarnecki of the Ave Maria School of Law gives us his analysis. John, so great to speak with you. How are you?
Marcus, I'm doing very well, and it's always a great pleasure to be on your program. Thank you for the invitation.
I always look forward to being able to reconnect with you, and I thank you for your objective astuteness in thinking of matters about the law in society. And this issue is no different. I invite you to share with our listeners the history of birthright citizenship so we have a context of continuing this conversation.
Yes, and thank you. I know that our time is limited, so this birthright citizenship issue comes from the text of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868 in the wake of the Civil War. Much of the 14th Amendment was concerned with slaves and the status of slaves. Section 1 begins with all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. And so the issue that comes down to us, to jump to today, and then we'll go back, is the meaning of the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So let me repeat. All persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So the almost customary interpretation of that has been, at least in so-called modern times, that if you're born in the United States, you're a citizen of the United States. But that ignores, or to date, let me put it more precisely, the courts have not directly and systematically addressed the meaning of the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
Mm-hmm.
And so think about that, Marcus. We've had in, again, modern times, the past century, the past 70 years, we've had thousands and thousands, maybe more, of people that are born in the United States, parents from foreign countries, and they've just been routinely assumed because of this clause to be citizens of the United States. And President Trump, entered an executive order refuting that, saying that essentially, and these are my words summarizing perhaps imperfectly, the executive order says, no, the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof means having full and unfettered allegiance to the United States, mm-hmm. not simply being in the United States when their child was born. And that is the question on which this Supreme Court case turns. And I, frankly, went to a very fine law school, of which I'm very proud. Mm-hmm. And the assumption there, and I think for decades, has been, well, if you're born on American soil, you're an American citizen. Well, it turns out that the history is much more complicated, mm-hmm. and this was reflected in the Supreme Court arguments.
I'm really glad. Oh, go ahead, please.
No. I wanted to give you a second. And by the way, there is, I usually don't cite things, but there was a superb summary of this in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal just after the argument by a professor named Randy Barnett, who's a well-established scholar at Georgetown Law School. And it does lay out what I'm about to as well. The folks that are arguing for the common understanding argue that the phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof simply means that you're in the United States and you're subject to the laws of the United States just by being here. So if I'm a foreigner and I run a stop sign, I'm subject to the traffic laws of the state. I mean, that's just very straightforward logic. And that's what their argument rests on, and that's been the common understanding. But it turns out that the history of the 14th Amendment is much more complicated than that, including two cases that are often cited on this issue. And it turns out that in this, whether you credit this or not, depends on your theory of constitutional jurisprudence, turns out that on the floor of the Senate and the House, the drafters were pretty clear that subject to the jurisdiction thereof doesn't mean simply being subject to the laws. It means owing allegiance to the country. So everyone agreed that children of diplomats, children of soldiers from an invading army, and at that time, at least, Native Americans who were still members of their tribes, all were excluded. So everyone to this day agrees that those were the categories. But it still leaves open the question, what about parents who are here illegally, mm-hmm. who have overstayed their visas, who are not permanent domiciliaries, green card holders, mm-hmm. Is the common term. What about them? And I know I'm speaking a lot here, but I'll give you two quick cases, and then I'm sure you have some questions if we have time. The first case Supreme Court took up on this was a case called Elk versus Wilkins, which simply stated that members of Native American tribes who are still members of their tribes were not subject to the jurisdiction. They didn't recognize allegiance to the U.S. Importantly, the court did not hold there that simply being born on American soil is enough. In fact, they adopted this idea that being subject to jurisdiction has to do with allegiance, a word that the justices in the recent case repeated over and over again. And then, very importantly, there's a case called U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark, mm-hmm. in 1898. Cited by both sides. And I, just to land the plane quickly here, Marcus, because I know your time is limited. There was a child in that case born in the United States, parents of Chinese descent, who at the time of his birth, his parents were subjects of the Emperor of China. And the court in that case did hold that that child was an American citizen because he was born in the United States. However, very importantly, and it was a topic of conversation at the Supreme Court, at that time, the parents were what we would call today permanent domiciliaries of the U.S. They were, at the time it didn't exist, but we would call that today green card holders. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting question. For decades, the assumption has been you're born on American soil, you're a citizen. But the case law does not, that everybody assumes supported that, does not exactly support that case. So what are the justices going to do with it? It's an open question.
You were right. We're just about a minute left in the segment, but I'm very grateful for that very comprehensive presentation of the issue at play here. I have one quick question then. Is there a sociopolitical benefit to the United States to rethink the scope, therefore, of birthright citizenship?
Sociopolitical. Well, I'm a person that believes that the only unlimited resource in the world is human talent. Mm-hmm. And so I'm, in general, pro-immigration. Mm-hmm. All of us are, in one way or another, almost all of us are the product of immigrants, as I proudly am. On the other hand, I also believe in the rule of law.
Yeah.
And birthright citizenship is a problem.
Yep. Well, I share that with you. John, thank you very, very much for making the time. My guest has been Dean John Czarnecki of the Ave Maria School of Law, and he has been sharing with us an analysis of the present case that Donald Trump essentially has brought before the Supreme Court pertaining to birthright citizenship, and we will follow this case closely. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town. Where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
What does Oratio Dominica mean? It refers to a prayer that is, according to the Catholic Catechism, truly unique. It is of the Lord. As the only Son of God the Father, Jesus, in speaking the words His Father gave Him, is the master of our prayer. In addition, as Word incarnate, Jesus, in his human heart, knows the needs of his human brothers and sisters. In revealing them to us, he is also the model of our prayer. Jesus, however, does not merely give us a formula to repeat mechanically. Jesus not only gives the words of the Our Father, he gives us the Spirit by whom the words become in us spirit and life. The prayer to our Father is inserted into the mysterious mission of the Son and the Spirit. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the Church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Catholic social doctrine perhaps remains one of the more misunderstood areas of Catholic teaching. Joining me to have a conversation about the origins of Catholic social doctrine is Matthew Walls. Matthew recently penned a two-part essay in Catholic World Report on the origins of Catholic social doctrine. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
Very glad to speak with you about this. I want to ask you to just begin by talking about what Catholic social doctrine actually is.
Yes, Catholic social doctrine is the Church's attempt, I guess most fundamentally, to shape the consciences of the faithful in their dealing with society at all levels. The family, first and foremost, the political community, secondly, and of course the Church as well. So in a certain way, it's an attempt to truly pastor souls as they try to navigate their social lives at each of these three levels.
Can you share with us the fundamental pillars or tenets of Catholic social doctrine?
Oh, yes, sure. Some of the fundamental, usually the Church's social doctrine or teaching is thought of according to four pillars or four dimensions. The first and most underlying is the dignity of the human person. So in some ways, the Church's whole tradition of anthropology bears on this, both the human person understood, you might say philosophically, as an animal with rationality, but also the human person understood theologically as made in God's own image, and as the Council teaches us, the most recent Council, the only creature on earth to be willed for its own sake. But this is coupled, you might say, or complemented, I should say, with other principles that are at work, one of which is solidarity, that we should stand together as a community, united in justice and charity, so that we are, in fact, mutually supporting one another in our social lives. Also, the principle of subsidiarity, which calls upon human beings in their social lives to exercise freedom at the level at which they are, in fact, the responsible agents. So a sort of push against any sort of overarching totalitarian sort of system where all delegation comes from above. And then finally, and sort of the icing on the cake, is the principle of the common good, that all of us share together and participate in a good that transcends any of our individual goods, the kinds of goods that we experience in communities where we see, for instance, that the good of the family brings with it dimensions of sociality and relationality that are beyond any given individual within that family. And that works its way up in terms of the goods of a political community, and also, of course, the goods of the Church. So those are the four basic principles: the dignity of the individual human person, solidarity, subsidiarity, and the common good.
There's a certain mooring here in reason, in philosophy. So all of these things that you've just shared, while deeply theological, can also be ascertained by some level by natural law. Can you please share with us about that?
Yes, I think that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's actually a really important dimension of Catholic social teaching, that of course it is rooted in revelation and the scriptures in particular, but it's also the teaching of the church that you might say is the most ready to hand and applicable in our everyday life, and therefore must take some of its moorings from human experience and what reason can gather from human experience. So, for instance, you know, if you think of any of those four principles that I laid out, the dignity of the human person, to root that in our experience of ourselves as free and moral agents, and the recognition of others as free and moral agents, which in a certain way you might say non-believers can see that as well. And certainly people who practice other religions besides Catholicism. And I would say the same thing in various ways for subsidiarity, to just realize in a certain way, according to reason, how communities best function in carrying out their activities. Don't they work better when those who are most responsible for the actions of the community are actually closest to the action itself? The common good, you can read about the common good in Aristotle, a pagan philosopher who understands that every community holds together according to a common good that surpasses any private good. And in some ways, we owe and have duties towards the common good. So, yeah, I think that philosophy in that sense plays a particular role in complementing what the scriptures and what the tradition have revealed about the nature of these societies and the right moral action within them, because, as I said earlier, these are closest to our everyday action, and therefore they, in a certain way, demand to be verified rationally so that we can understand the good both naturally and supernaturally that we are pursuing in our everyday lives, in our social lives.
Why do you highlight figures like Newman and Pope Leo XIII in this conversation on faith and reason?
Yeah, so, you know, in some ways, the social teaching of the church, in one respect, you might say, was there from the beginning of the church. You know, it's in there in the scriptures in various ways. But when we talk about the church's social teaching tradition, we almost always go back to Leo XIII, who began this most explicitly in a magisterial way, to begin publishing what are called social encyclicals. And I mentioned him because he also at that very moment was introducing, or reintroducing, you might say, Thomas Aquinas back into the primary shaper or teacher within the intellectual life of the church. And so one of the reasons in my article that I refer to Newman is because Newman had this funny experience in Rome when he wanted to become a Catholic priest after he had converted, and they suggested that he go to Rome in order to enter seminary, as it were, even though he was older and a rather well-respected intellectual already. But he does go to Rome looking for some good philosophy, especially the thought of Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle. And he found in the middle of the 1800s that it just wasn't there in Rome, that Rome in a certain way had, I don't know, gotten lazy, as it were, in keeping up its perennial philosophic tradition. And so he makes a funny prediction in my article. I begin with Newman and a kind of prediction. He says that the Pope has to do something about this. And about 30 years later is when the encyclical Aeterni Patris is published, that brings Thomas Aquinas back into the forefront of Catholic intellectual life. And so partly what I'm trying to argue in my article is to really point out how Newman, seeing this problem, Leo, who had seen this problem in other ways, that part of the problem of the modern political situation we find ourselves in is that it's rooted in philosophy that is either diminishes or distorts, especially the dignity of the human person, and then all that comes from that. And so in a certain way, Newman, Leo, and both of them in terms of looking for Aquinas and Aristotle as support are important in seeing how the church came to a realization that in a certain way they had to address the remnants or the not the remnants, the consequences of the philosophies that were in Europe at the time from the Enlightenment, from philosophies that were trying to, in a certain way, teach about man apart from God. And the solution to that was the magisterial social teaching.
My guest is Matthew Walls. He's recently penned a two-part article on the origins of Catholic social doctrine. He will begin serving as president of Thomas More College this September. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here, and I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I'm going to tell you about the most abused woman I ever met in my life. You know her name as Roe, as in Roe versus Wade. I talked to Roe. This woman is a great penitent. This woman is a humble person who was deeply hurt. She was kneeling in the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, the National Shrine in Washington, when I met her. And I thought, what reverence. I didn't know who this woman was, but she was praying with reverence, with great fervor. And I asked a priest friend of mine, who is that? And he says, oh, that's Roe. God is not mocked. This woman was abused by those who propagate the killing of children.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Christ is the answer. With Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. He says that often in the Gospels. He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die. To which the Jews say, now we know you have a demon. And they say, Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died? And Jesus says, your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad. To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Pease. I'm talking with Matthew Walls. He is soon to be the president of Thomas More College this September in 2026. He will begin serving then. He's also the author of a two-part article on the origins of Catholic social doctrine and why it's crucial. Matthew, to pick up where we left off, I want to ask you to explain to us the impact of Aeterni Patris, Leo XIII's encyclical. What did it do for the life of the Church, and especially the study of theology?
Yeah, that's a great question, Marcus. I think to understand that, I started to say a little bit about this in the last segment, but we have to be aware of what influence modern philosophy had in Europe at the time, especially at the time of the French Revolution. And in a certain way, there's a deep push to naturalize, you might say, the entire order, or what we might call now secularism, right? To sort of secularize all reality and try to understand reality in a kind of anti-theological way.
Mm-hmm.
And in Thomas Aquinas, of course, you get the great symphony, you might say, and harmony of faith and reason. So as a kind of response to this secularization project of modernity, Leo comes in with a view that is trying to recover a more holistic understanding of the intellectual life, not at the cost of nature and naturalness, but to realize that nature itself points also beyond itself, and that actually nature, in a certain way, is lost if you lose that sacramental understanding of it that was so crucial to Christianity. So in a certain way, Aeterni Patris, by bringing Thomas Aquinas back into the conversation very explicitly, in fact, you might even say legislatively, insofar as Leo basically demanded that seminarians be trained in the thought of Aquinas, was a really crucial move to sort of recover that tradition. It didn't go necessarily all that smoothly because, as I was saying earlier, in some ways the Church was, had forgotten some of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a little clunky at first. It wasn't quite clear exactly how to do this. And I wouldn't say that we're still in the process of this. I think now, if you turn to seminaries especially, you'll see that the study of Aquinas has a sort of central place now, balanced, of course, with, making sure they know contemporary philosophy and the whole history of philosophy. But there is, in a certain way, the seminaries have overcome this sort of falling prey to modern philosophy as apart from theology. And Thomas Aquinas, who was promoted in Aeterni Patris, is at the center of that discussion, you might say.
The other aspect that you raise is about Aeterni Patris' social impact. How is it a social document?
Yeah, and that's in some ways one of the claims of my article that I kind of came to that maybe spurred me to write this mm-hmm. article was, at the beginning of Aeterni Patris, which, is known in the Church as reintroducing Thomas to seminaries, you might say, what's that have to do with social teaching? Well, it's clear that it's not just for seminaries, although that's the first place. It is also in some ways for all the faithful, the lay faithful included, number one. And number two, it's in the context of thinking about the role that philosophy, you might say, worldviews, if you want to put that a little less strictly as a discipline, but what do sort of cultural and worldviews, what influence do they have mm-hmm. on society? And what happens when a certain kind of philosophy or worldview starts to take over? I mentioned already, say, secularism. How does that actually affect society? So it turns out that the study of philosophy and coming to a kind of a wise view of the whole and a wise understanding of human nature, all of that actually has very important social ramifications. You know, if you think that, for instance, the human being is just an advanced sort of animal only, that view of human nature, a philosophical view of nature, will affect the way that you're going to legislate, for instance, about human beings and how they can be treated. So philosophy plays a really crucial role in sort of the background of society. And I think even though Eterni Patris looks like it's more directly oriented towards something that has to do with the intellectual life of the church, it's clear from its opening paragraphs, this is in service of the faithful who are living in the world in a certain way under the influence of bad philosophy, and maybe even imbibing it in ways that they are unaware of.
You've mentioned how the church had, by the time Eterni Patris came about, a lot of factions in the church had largely forgotten the crucial role and rapprochement of reason to the faith. And now we are seeing a return, a significant balance in that presentation. Are there still factions within the church that see this as suspect and would prefer to return to a completely, almost fideistic presentation of revelation and theology only?
Yeah, boy, that's a tough question. I mean, in some ways, those are, you know, on the one hand, I would, you know, this is maybe punting on the question. These are perennial temptations, mm-hmm. you might say. I do think that, you know, when modern philosophy was wedded to, or at least thought in the minds of people to be wedded to scientific progress very closely, mm-hmm. and we can argue about whether that's true or false, I think in some ways the temptation was much greater to punt on the faith-reason question, to think that reason has its own domain and faith has its own domain. I think Leo's sort of on the edge where at the end of the 1800s, and you know some of the revolutions that had taken place within the last century or so, even dating back to the French Revolution, things got kind of ugly. And in a certain way, those were not surprising given some of the philosophical understandings of the political community or of the human person that were being trumpeted by the philosophers. So in a certain way, I would say like the proof is in the pudding in a certain sense. So it does seem to me we're in a better position to judge the fruitfulness of the modern philosophic project. And by that I'm talking about the sort of thoroughgoing dualism of Descartes and mm-hmm. how he understands the human person, or Hobbes understands the state of nature as the basis of society, a war of all against all. Some of those have their sort of replays in our age with, you know, the wokeism or the pseudo-Marxism that we're dealing with in our own contemporary society. It does seem to me, though, that the church herself, if I could put it this way, seems more united. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with what Leo himself inaugurated. In a certain way, you could argue, without Leo, you don't get the council. You don't get a sort of looking back to our sources in conversation with contemporary philosophy and theology. And in a certain way, Aquinas is kind of the middle term of that. Aquinas, who himself is a kind of synthesizing thinker who's trying to bring the whole patristic tradition into conversation with Aristotle, with contemporary medieval thought in his time. So all of that leads to like a kind of recovery of that historical awareness, that this idea that philosophy is just getting always better and better, and therefore the latest philosophy is by definition the best philosophy, becomes a little bit suspect, I would mm-hmm. say.
Share with us then the immense benefit that we've seen in the modern life of the church now, ever since the reclamation of Thomistic thought and therefore natural philosophy done right in connection with the faith.
Yeah. Wow. That's a great question again. I mean, I'm a big student, you might say, mm-hmm. of John Paul II and Karol Wojtyła. So in some ways, my mind goes to him as a man who maybe, by the way, a pope who has very interesting parallels with Leo XIII, both end of their century, both with very long pontificates that sort of set a tone. You could say Leo's connected with Vatican I in a way and John Paul to Vatican II. So there's interesting parallels there. And I would argue that in John Paul II, you see in some ways the fruit of Eterni Patris, a man who is deeply grounded in the thought of Thomas Aquinas and in a certain way imbibes his spirit of realism, of attention to the human person, of the harmony between faith and reason, but like Thomas, very much in conversation with contemporary thought, deeply rooted in the tradition, especially the Greek philosophic tradition. So partly if we value the papacy and the magisterium of John Paul II, it seems to me we're kind of seeing there the fruit of Eterni Patris and what Leo XIII envisioned in terms of an intellectual life. That's maybe an argument more by like a certain example, right? Mm-hmm. and yet I think you can see in the church, and I see it, I work with seminarians, I work with young Catholic students in college, you see in them a kind of spirit of Thomas Aquinas that wants to be both rooted in that tradition and able to talk and dialogue with contemporary society.
Matthew, I'm looking forward to future conversations. My guest has been Matthew Walls. He is soon to start as president of Thomas More College in September 2026. I'm Marcus Peter.